This is the Physics 102 lecture for Monday, November 2nd, 2009. You will want to find the accompanying PDF file entitled Particle Physics for the bulk of this lecture. At the end, I will be switching to Particle Physics 2. There are technical reasons that I'm using two different files. The first one will be PDF. The second one is, out of necessity, going to have to be in PowerPoint, so sorry about that. The other technical issue I'm having at the moment is that in the first file I'm having an issue modifying the master slide to get page numbers, so that's going to be a bit of a pain. So what I'll do is, I don't have time to solve that technical issue right now, so what I'm going to do is actually describe the pages as I get to them, and I apologize for not having the page numbers down. At any rate, the topic that I want to discuss with you is particle physics, which is what I do for a living, and it's actually a very exciting field, but I think when you first hear about it, there are lots of new names and everything, so it can seem rather overwhelming and strange. At any rate, so on page one of the particle physics PDF file, I have a page of links where you can learn more about particle and nuclear physics if you wish. I have put up on the website for reading in the class the link to Particle Adventure, which I think is worth your while. It's designed for beginners in particle to learn about particle physics, and I think it's a pretty reasonable place to start. At any rate, let's go to slide 2, where I have a picture of Albert Einstein, basically telling you about how I got started in this business. For me, I wanted to know what is the nature of matter, and I picture beside Al sort of a modern picture of an atom where you have this nucleus. Of course, it's immensely blown up relative to the electron orbitals. Surrounded by electron orbitals, which we know aren't really circular, but who cares. This picture makes some sense when you're thinking about the electrons, because they're attracted toward the positive nucleus. The electrons are negative, and they move. I mean, you can think of them as moving in Bohr orbits with the electrical force providing the centripetal force. But if you now look at this picture of the atom and you think about what it means for the nucleus, it means that you have all of these positive charges in very close to one another, and there's a tremendous force that is going to blow the nucleus apart. So in order to understand this, I mean, I've said that one way to look at this to say, well, people did scattering experiments, and they saw that, in fact, particles up until a very close distance to the nucleus, about 10 to the minus 15 meters from the nucleus, the scattering was as if you had Coulomb scattering, and then inside of that you had evidence of a new force, which is called the strong force. And so the idea is that you can push these nucleons together, and the protons, for example, might repel one another, but when you get them close enough together, there's an attractive force that's stronger than the Coulomb force that holds things together. And if you want to learn more about the strong force, you need to somehow probe the nucleus, but that's easier said than done. So what people have really done through the years is let me step back. Let's go to the third slide where you see pictures of cars wrecking. You can imagine if you wanted to know how a car works, but you weren't allowed to open the hood, one way of trying to learn more about the essence of cars would be to take cars and speed them around a racetrack and crash them into one another and to look at the pieces that come out. And basically, you would discover that no matter what the brand of the car or how fast they were going, you would get wheels and spark plugs, but it would happen to be only when you're driving Volvos that you get Volvo symbols. And basically, by crashing together lots of cars and looking at the debris, you could figure out what it is that is the essence of the car, what makes the car work. And this is basically the game that particle physicists have done through the years. Let's go to slide 4, where you see a high-rise building on the left and a couple of rings on the right-hand side. These are aerial views of Fermi National Accelerator near Chicago. And what we do in particle physics is we send particles around racetracks rather than cars, and we bash them into one another. But the basic principle is really the same. What we've done for many years is to take different types of beams and crash them together at different energies and keep track of the debris that comes out. And from that debris, we try to reconstruct what's going on. And after many years and many experiments, we have been able to ferret out patterns and develop a model of what actually is happening as you go inside the nucleus. If you go to slide 4 still, you can see on the left-hand side is what's known as the Fermilab high-rise. So on some of my trips, in fact, that's where I'm sitting. It's one of the coolest buildings in the world if you ever get the chance. It's in Batavia, Illinois. On the right-hand side is an aerial view of the accelerator rings. And so what happens is that the charged particles are accelerated, and as they gain energy, you bend them by using magnets in a circle. And the reason that you put them in a circle is you basically can reuse the tunnel as you accelerate the thing. So you have little accelerators that occupy just a little piece of the circle, and then the beam goes around, and every time it comes back around, you accelerate it just a little bit more, and you increase the strength of the magnetic field. And after a while, you have very, very powerful beams circulating in a magnetic field. It's called a proton synchrotron, that particular device. At any rate, let's go to slide 5. In order to detect the particles, we build very large detectors with many different elements of detecting particles. And so, for example, on the left-hand side, you see an experiment called the CDF experiment, which stands for Collider Detector Facility. And you see sort of these different donut annular pieces going out and sort of stuffed into a square box. And the beam basically collides in the middle of this device, coming down and going right through the middle of the donut. The beam line isn't shown, but these two people that are standing right by the CDF detector are basically looking right up at where the beam would be going into the detector. But when the collision happens, the particles that are formed in the collision just basically spray out into the detector, and there are different types of detection elements within the overall big detector that can give you information. So a way to think about it is if you were trying to understand car wrecks, you could look at the debris and try to understand something about the car. So, for example, you could look at the skid marks and understand that the car was trying to stop, and you could look at how the car scattered off of something else and get some idea of what the speed was and the direction that the car was going. So there are ways in which you can look at things that are coming out and reconstruct what's going on, and that's more or less what we do. So there are lots of different ways to detect particles, but usually we take advantage of the fact that as charged particles go through substances, they ionize the gas or the solid, and you can collect the ions and get a little electrical pulse on it, and that's more or less what we do. If you go to the next slide, which would be slide 6 if you're counting, there's a picture of the Stanford Linear Accelerator, which is... It actually goes underneath Interstate 280 south of San Francisco. If you're ever there, you'll be driving along 280, and all of a sudden you'll see this weird building that looks very long, both to the right and left of the interstate. And in fact, it is. It's about 2 kilometers long, and it houses the power supplies that feed an accelerator that's about 20 feet underneath them. And the cutaway of the accelerator is on the lower right, and basically it feeds arcs which bend the beams, which then collide the beams inside of detectors, which is sort of shown here. If you were to look at the detector, which we have pictured on slide 6 at the end of the accelerator, it's called the SLD detector. If you, it's about, that detector is not being used anymore, but it's about 3 to 4 stories cube, basically. And if we were to collide electrons and anti-electrons in the middle of it and look at the computer-generated picture of the particles coming out of such a collision, you would see something like you see on slide 7. This is actually a real event from this experiment. And you can basically imagine that in the middle of this detector, where there's a white region, the two beams collide, and what you're looking from the beam's eye view, so they're going in and out of the paper as you see it, and they collide, and many particles are formed, and you actually see the green tracks. What happens is these charged particles pass through a region containing a gas and wires, and when the gas gets ionized, the ions drift to the nearest wire, and we get an electrical pulse. So it actually allows us to reconstruct tracks, charged tracks, wherever the charged particles go. And you actually see that representation in the green tracks as they stream through the black region there in the middle. And then the tracks continue outward from the center, and they hit sort of this blue region with lots of multicolored polygons coming off. And what happens there, there's a detector where when the tracks hit it, they are destroyed. So basically this detector is made up of lead with a detection element between layers of lead. And when the particles hit the lead, they lose their energy, but that we collect some of the energy, and the amount of energy we collect is given by these multicolored polygons. And the way in which the energy is deposited in this blue device tells us a lot about the nature of the particle. So this is a picture of how we do particle physics these days and look at the nature of matter. And the rest of the talk is primarily going to be what we learn, but I wanted to at least give you a sense of how we get at that information. On slide 8, this actually is a little movie from CERN, which I will call Movie 1 on the website if I can get it downloaded. And then on slide 9, I'll call it's another movie, which I'll call Movie 2. So these are movies from the CERN laboratory that illustrate the size and scope of the Large Hadron Collider project, which is turning on next month if all goes well. And maybe we'll talk more about that project later. But these are sort of cool movies, so I wanted to show them to you. I'll try to get them posted on the web. Anyway, it's a shame that I'm having to do this particular lecture using this format, because I can't show you the movies without, you'll have to look at them yourself. Can't look at them together. All right, so I'd like to go to slide 10 now. On slide 10, I have a picture of Al sticking his tongue out at you, and there's a bunch of questions. I mean, suppose you start colliding particles, or these cars as they're going around the track. One of the biggest questions that comes up is, how exactly do they interact with one another? If I send particles toward one another and they crash, what exact forces are they encountering, and why is it that we create these sprays of particles coming off? What exactly do we mean by a force? How do these particles interact? And then things get particularly strange or complicated if you imagine that One of the things we'll learn when we begin to learn more about astronomy and cosmology is that when you study the sky, it seems that all of the galaxies in the universe are basically moving away from us. So we happen to know that the space in the universe is expanding. If you extrapolate back in time, there was a time when the universe was actually very hot and dense compared to what it is now. And that means it's relevant to try to understand what is the nature of forces and the nature of matter at very high energy densities. And it turns out that it's not at all the same as what it is at low energies. So we need to understand not only what forces exist in nature and what kinds of things interact, what kinds of things exist in nature, what kinds of matter, what are the particles that are out there, how they interact with each other, what forces exist, and we need to know how these forces change with energy or temperature, which are basically interchangeable quantities. And from this, we can actually study the early stages of the universe where there was much more energy available. This is a way, one of the ways, I promised you at the very start of the course that one of the things that you were going to see is that there's an intimate relationship between the very small and the very large. And this is one of the places where it gets all tied together. If you want to understand the large-scale evolution of the universe in the early stages, you really have to understand also the nature of the forces and particles that could exist at that time. So people have done lots of studies. If you go to slide 11, what you see is a mishmash. Actually, this slide is meant to be animated. Maybe I will post the PowerPoint slide on the web as well as the PDF slides for this. If you're looking at the PowerPoint version, you'll find this animated. Basically, all I'm trying to say with this is that we have run many, many experiments basically of this nature, looking at different types of beams, different energies, the things that come out, and we have created thick catalogs full of different types of interactions. We understand the probabilities that certain particles will decay into certain others. We know what kinds of particles generated when you crash certain types of beams together. So there's a tremendous amount of information that we found. And from all of this information, we have developed a model which we call the standard model, which I guess sounds sort of arrogant, and it is sort of arrogant, and in fact, I have to say it really deserves to be, because the standard model works extraordinarily well to describe almost anything that we've been able to see. So what I want to describe for you are the very basics of the standard model. So if we go to slide 12, in order to understand the standard model, we're going to first do this mini PhD in quantum mechanics. I mean, I guess we've already done some of this, but the first lesson in this is that size really does matter. We've already seen that in our study of quantum mechanics. If you go to slide 13, remember that what I really mean by that is that you can determine the position and velocity of a car with no problem. If it's macroscopic, you just bounce light off it. If you go to slide 14, but the problem when you try to bounce light off of a small particle, you no longer are measuring. If you bounce light off it to get the position, sorry, position's misspelled, you'll no longer have the velocity that you initially had. So the uncertainty principle comes into play with quantum things. So if you go to slide 15, this is a picture of Heisenberg, and basically it's the statement that you cannot have perfect knowledge of the position and the velocity, which we've already seen. We also saw that there's another form of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which states that the uncertainty in the energy of a system times the lifetime of the system, or the time, the uncertainty in the time over which the system exists, is also greater than some finite number, the Planck constant. And we also know that E equals mc squared from Einstein. So if you recall, we talked about this a little bit earlier. If we had a particle, an electron, so in the middle of this slide you can see some electron moving from left to right, and about midway the electron emits a photon. And that photon turns into an electron and a positron represented by a circle. And then they come back together and you get the photon which comes back to the original electron. And you might say, okay, that can't happen. But in fact, due to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, it can happen so long as it happens over such a very short time that nobody's the wiser. The reason that, and we call these particles that have this fleeting existence that aren't really there, but they represent possibilities of something that could happen within the context of the uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics. So within quantum mechanics, anything that could happen basically does happen, which means if you want to understand the essence of an electron, you have to understand all of the possible ways in which this electron could be manifest in virtual particles. So you have to sum up all the various possibilities. So you basically have to look at an electron not so much as a marble, but as sort of this cloud of virtual particles that are seething, going in and out of existence very quickly. So down below, and I picture two electrons passing near each other, and you can imagine that each have have virtual clouds of particles. And if we imagine that one of these virtual particles gets exchanged from one of the electrons to the other, that would be a force, because these virtual particles, although they're only there momentarily, they actually do carry the charge of the particle and the momentum of the particle. And if I exchange momentum, then I actually am exchanging a force. So this is the basic essence of a force in quantum field theory. If we go to slide 17, this isn't so foreign to us. It's an exchange force, and we see these in the macroscopic world all the time. So you can imagine two people standing on ice exchanging a heavy ball back and forth, and when they do, there's basically a force between them. If the guy on the left throws the ball to the guy on the left is actually going to move to the left because of momentum conservation, and when the guy on the right catches the ball, the momentum of the ball is going to push him to the right. So it's basically a repulsive exchange force that they get when they exchange this ball. In quantum field theory, the momentum could be such that, depending on the force and what's going on, it could be positive or negative. But the essence of the force that you see in this idea of quantum field theory depends on what particle is exchanged exactly. So if we go to slide 18, we know of four fundamental forces in nature. And in fact, we'll find that we can combine a couple of these in a few minutes. But if you go out and you make basic measurements in the world, there seem to be four characteristic forces. One is gravitation, which you're very familiar with, and gravitation comes about and is felt by particles that have mass. So that's the source. The range of gravitation is infinite. It may become very weak, very, very far away, but it's infinite. And the fundamental strength of gravitation, and this may seem very strange, it is 10 to the minus 39 on a relative scale, where the strength of what we'll call the strong nuclear force is 1. So the fundamental strength of gravitation is actually very low. It's a very weak force. The next force on the list is electromagnetism. Only particles that have electric charge feel electromagnetism, just like gravitation. It's an infinite range, And its strength is 10 to the minus 2, or it is 10 to the 37th times stronger than gravitation. You sort of know this is true because we've calculated the gravitational force between an electron and proton in the Bohr atom, and we've compared that to the electrical force between the two, and you saw that the ratio of those two was some large number. Well, and the ratio of electromagnetic to gravity was very large. So we've calculated that before. The third force I'll introduce you to is the strong nuclear force, and this is the force that basically binds the nucleus together. It connects to something which is known as color charge, which may sound a little bit weird. We'll talk about it in another moment, but mass is basically the charge of gravity. Electric charge is the charge for electromagnetism, and something called color charge is the charge for the strong nuclear force. The strong nuclear force has a range of about 10 to the minus 15 meters. You might say, well, how do you know that? Well, I know that because if we push particles toward one another, there's no evidence of the strong force until they're about 10 to the minus 15 meters from one another. And then it turns on, and it's very, very strong. And I know that it's stronger than electromagnetism because it actually binds the nucleus together. It overpowers the Coulomb repulsion between the protons. So in the relative strength table, we say that the strength of the strong force is 1. At the bottom is the weak nuclear force, which has an extremely short range, 10 to the minus 18 meters, and it is weaker than electromagnetism, but it's nowhere near as weak as gravity. What actually makes it fairly weak is that its range is so short, the probability of particles getting that close to one another is so small that basically it just doesn't happen very often, which is sort of a measure of its strength. That's a way to think about it anyway. So we have gravitation, electromagnetism, and the strong nuclear force, and the weak nuclear force. So those are the four basic forces of nature that we need to keep in mind. Let's go to slide 19. Slide 19, here are the fundamental particles according to the standard model. And you won't recognize many of these. There are 6 particles which are known as quarks. And you see the U and the D quark, the C quark, the S quark, the T quark, and the B quark. Now it's where things get a little bit odd here because we have strange names for these beasts. The U quark is also known as the up quark. The D is the down quark. The C is the charm quark. The S is the strange quark. The T is the top quark. And the B is the bottom quark. I know those names sound ridiculous. The truth is that quarks were hypothesized to exist before there was any real evidence for them. And so to some extent, they were hypothesized as a mathematical tool, and they did seem to bring some order to the various particles and how they were categorized. And in the end, it turned out we actually found evidence for quarks, so they appear to be quite real, and we're sort of stuck with the whimsical names that were assigned to them initially. And there's some stories about the different quarks and how they got some of their names, but I won't bore you with those now. At any rate, you say, we haven't heard of quarks before. What have we heard of? We've heard of electrons and photons and protons and neutrons. Well, the way it works is that quarks have fractional electric charge. That's another thing that we've never heard of before. The up quark has an electric charge of plus 2/3 times E, and the down quark has an electric charge of minus 1/3 times E. So if I take 2 up quarks and 1 down quark, I have a total charge of plus 1. And the proton is made of 2 up quarks and a down quark. If I have 1 up quark and 2 down quarks, then I have a neutral particle, and the neutron is made of 1 up quark and 2 down quarks. So quarks basically are point-like particles that make up the heavier particles like protons and neutrons. They also make up other types of particles that you don't normally see in everyday life, called mesons, or things like so-called pions, which are made of quarks and anti-quarks. So I'll come back and talk about antimatter in a moment. That's the quark sector, and we'll come back to that. Below the quarks in green are the leptons. One lepton you're actually very familiar with, which is the electron. In addition to the electron, to the right of it is a symbol mu. That stands for the muon, and to the right of that is a symbol tau, which stands for the tau particle. It turns out that the muon and the tau are nothing more than very fat electrons. They're significantly heavier than the electron, but they have all the basic characteristics of electrons. The electron, muon, and the tau all just have electric charge, and they do not feel the strong force. That's why electrons are not bound inside a nuclei. The quarks, on the other hand, all feel the strong force, so they get bound inside of protons and neutrons and nuclei. Above the electron, muon, and tau, you'll see the nu sub e, the nu sub mu, and the nu sub tau. These are known as neutrinos. These are almost massless particles. They're not exactly massless, and they do not have electric charge. They only interact via the so-called weak interaction, which doesn't happen very often. So what that means is if I have a neutrino gun and I shoot a neutrino, it could go through many, many light years of lead without interacting with the lead. So they basically seldom interact with matter. If I have enough neutrinos, if I have a gun that shoots, you know, 10 to the 20th neutrinos, then I'll see them interact. So this is actually how we study them. We create beams that are quite intense, and we can actually then study, even with fairly high statistics, neutrino interactions with matter. On the right-hand side, in the purple, these are the particles that carry the force. So we've talked about how the electromagnetic force is carried by this so-called exchange of a virtual photon, which is the top member of this quartet. The other forces are carried by the other particles. The G stands for the gluon, and that is the particle that carries the strong nuclear force. The Z and the W actually are two different particles. The W has charge and the Z does not, and these carry the weak nuclear force. A lot all at once, I know. I'm sorry about that, but we just sort of have to jump into it, and I'll try to give you in time a better feeling for how these things all fit together. So let's go to slide 20, and let me spend just a moment to, because I talked a little bit about antimatter. It turns out that all particles have antiparticles, and if it's a charged particle, that generally means that you have a particle that is identical to it but has the opposite charge. And a particle and antiparticle, when they come together, will actually annihilate one another into photons. If you have a quantum fluctuation creating matter, and we've talked about that happening in a vacuum, for example, you basically have to conserve charge, so you don't just create an electron or a positron. You create an electron-positron pair. So typically what happens is you get electron-positron pairs formed. We don't really know yet why. Well, it's not we don't really know. We do not know why the universe is matter instead of antimatter, or a mix between the two. There's clearly, because when we look out in the universe, it seems to be clearly dominated by matter. We do see there antimatter is made in some high energy processes, and certainly in our accelerators. But the dominant species in the universe is matter, and we don't really know why that is, and it's one of the mysteries that many of us are studying right now. It's one of the puzzles that we have with particle physics, is to understand this matter-antimatter asymmetry. So let's go to slide 21. Slide 21 shows there's a blue square that basically gives a graphical representation of an atom. So working from outside in, if we look on the upper right-hand side of the atom, you see the electron. And the size of the atom itself is about 10 to the minus 10 meters. Then, as we work our way in the sort of bluish region, is the nucleus. And the nucleus is made up of, and it's around, say, 10 to the minus 14 meters, I guess. I've probably been a little bit loose with my numbers, and I've called it 10 to the minus 15. The size of the proton and the neutron each is about 10 to the minus 15 meters. So if you put a bunch of them together, you'll get something in a nucleus that's a bit bigger, you know, 10 to the minus 14 meters. Inside the proton and neutron, they're made up of quarks. And you can see the different combinations of quarks, the two D's and a U for the neutron and the two U's and a D for the proton. And the quarks are very tiny. In fact, we've never really measured any structure to a quark. And to just get a sense, we've talked about neutron stars already. If we were to take the mass of the sun, or something roughly that size, and compress it to where it's the density of matter in this nucleus, it would be only about 10 kilometers across. Okay, so let's go to slide 22. So in slide 22, we see graphical representations of virtual particles getting exchanged. So in the upper left-hand side, you see two electrons basically exchanging a squiggly line, which is a so-called virtual photon. And that is, within quantum field theory, the view of the essence of electromagnetism. It's the exchange of a virtual photon. On the upper right, you see an electron coming in from the left on the upper leg, and it turns into an electron neutrino kicking out a W, which is going straight down. A muon neutrino coming in from the left collects the W, turns onto a muon. So basically, electrons can decay. I'm sorry. Electrons and muons can scatter off of one another basically via this process. And this is an example of something known as a weak interaction. I'm sorry, I just need to look ahead to make sure I know what I'm saying when. The weak interaction is particularly short-ranged, and the reason for this is that the W is very massive. A photon has no mass. So what that means is, if we go according to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle that you see on the upper left here on slide 22, if I were to create a photon, it could have, in principle, an extremely low frequency, which means its energy could be really infinitesimally small, which means I only need to violate conservation of energy, if you want to think of it that way, by a little tiny bit, which means I can do it for a fairly long time, which means that at the speed of light it can go a pretty good distance. So that's a way of saying that the electromagnetic force has a long range. On the other hand, if we look at the weak interaction where a W particle gets exchanged, a W particle has a mass of about 80-something protons. It's a tremendous mass for a single particle. It's as much as most atoms. And for that particle to be formed as a virtual particle, the uncertainty in the energy, the delta E, that you have to have is tremendous, which means the delta T is very small, which means the W can only exist as a virtual particle for an extraordinarily short time. And because of that, even at the speed of light, it can only go about 10 to the minus 18 meters. And that's what limits the weak interaction's range. So the weak interaction is very short. Below that, you see two quarks represented by Qs. interacting via this really squiggly, looks like a spring sort of line, which is called a gluon. So the strong force comes about from the exchange of gluons. And you can see some of the characteristics of these virtual particles that get exchanged. We do have a stupid name for them because that's what we do in particle physics. We call these virtual particles that carry the force and get exchanged, we call them gauge bosons. So you can see the gauge bosons on the page 22. Let's go to page 23. Page 23, again, you see the four forces of nature, and in the first row, after the title row, you can see the gravitation acts on mass, the weak interaction acts on weak charge, but actually, because we need stupid names, we call it flavor charge in the business. Don't ask me why. The electromagnetic interaction interacts on electric charge, and the strong interaction interacts on something called color charge, which I'll try to motivate for you in a couple minutes. I think there's nothing on this slide that we haven't actually already said. On the lower level, there's a table, a lower row, there's a table of the relative strength of the different forces at slightly different distances as well, which is sort of a fine point we don't need to worry about. On page 24, quarks, you never see quarks in nature. What you see are quarks bound in other particles, and quarks are bound two different ways. They can be bound as a threesome, or they can be bound as a quark and an anti-quark pair. When they're bound as a threesome, they're called a baryon, which is Greek for heavy. When they're bound as a quark-antiquark pair, they're a particle called a meson. So this sounds sort of crazy. Examples of baryons that you know of in the real world is the proton and the neutron, but there are others which are listed, and you can actually see the quark content of them and their electric charge and their masses. On the lower table are examples of mesons, and lower energy mesons or lower mass mesons that we see are the pion and the kaon, and you can see the quark content of some of these particles. But truthfully, we have catalogs filled with particles like this, which we can understand through the quark picture. It's a little more complicated than saying a particle's essence is decided by just the quarks that make it up. It's also true that the quarks can occupy different energy levels, you know, like they can spin around each other really fast or something. And because the quarks can occupy basically different quantum levels, that creates different mass particles with different characteristics, basically. So that's a little bit of how the quark picture works. Now, the interesting thing about quarks is that it's a force between particles that we say have color. Well, it turns out there are three types of color charge, and if you have no color charge, then there is no strong force. But you can imagine if you had three types of so-called color charge, red, blue, and green, and you mix them all together, then you would have something that's sort of whitish, a little bit like light. And so it turns out that within this particular model, within the force known as the strong nuclear force, we say that the force is not present if there is no color charge. And it turns out that if you have three different quarks with three different colors and you mix them together, say in a baryon, then it's as if you took three different colors of light and mixed it together and came with white light. So the baryon does not have a color charge and therefore doesn't feel the strong force. But the quarks inside it do. So that's why you can have a stable proton without it necessarily having the strong interaction happening all around it. The same is true if I have a quark and an anti-quark where they have a color and an anti-color. If I mix a color and an anti-color, I get basically no color, which is why the meson is stable. So that's sort of a sense of why these are the two types of bound states that you can have for quarks. So I'll come back and tell you a little bit more about the strong force in just a moment. But let's go to slide 25. Slide 25 tries to pull it all together a little bit to give you a sense of how some of these things come together. We have the quarks in the upper left, the leptons, and the gauge bosons. What do you actually see? Well, it turns out that the quarks mix together in twos as quarks and antiquarks, or three quarks, to form baryons or mesons, which, because we need more stupid names, we collectively call hadrons. Two types of these baryons, the proton and the neutron, are joined together in nuclei, which form atoms with the electrons. So you can see that there's still lots of particles that you don't seem to necessarily need out in nature or see out in nature in everyday life, but if you go up to higher energies, you actually will see all these other particles. So let's go to slide 26. You're going to need animation happening for this slide to make any sense. If the animation's working, when you get to the first bit of the page, you'll see a picture. I'm trying to explain why bare quarks have never been observed. There's a graph on the upper right which gives you a basic measure of the relative strength of the strong nuclear interaction as a function of the distance between two colored particles. And what you see is, as I take two particles with color charge and I separate them, the strength of the nuclear force becomes stronger and stronger. On the horizontal scale, I show you that distance goes to the right, so that's as I pull the particles apart. And I say that energy density or temperature goes to the left. And the reason I say that is, imagine you have two protons and you're trying to push them together. If you're in a system which has more and more energy or higher and higher temperature, then they're moving faster and faster and they're more likely to be able to get very close to one another. So if you want to ask how things operate as a function of temperature, then the strong nuclear force in a very hot medium, a very high energy density, tends to be very weak. So that's why the energy density and temperature go to the left. Anyway, so what happens is the strong force becomes stronger as I separate two particles. This is very different from the electromagnetic force, where the strong force becomes, where the force becomes weaker as I separate them. So if you've got the animated version on, look at the next bit of the slide, and you see a proton with quarks moving bound inside it, and we call it a white proton because it's colorless when you have the three colored quarks together. And hit the next selection. Now go to the next. What I'd like to do is to bash this particle. So if you go to the next, you see the silly duck getting ready to bash the proton in order to knock a quark out of the proton. And when you try to knock a quark out of the proton, what happens is that the colored particles separate and the strength between them becomes very much greater. As the strength between them becomes so much greater, basically the energy density in the space between these separating particles becomes very high. And after a while, it becomes energetically favorable to pull a particle-antiparticle pair out of the vacuum and create two colorless particles. So go to the next selection on this slide. If you have that energy density in space, remember energy is equal to mc squared. Energy and mass are two faces of the same thing, so I can create a particle-antiparticle pair out of the vacuum if I have enough energy there. And so go select the next piece of that slide. And the particle and antiparticle will then join the different particles and create two white particles. So instead of getting a bare quark, you get a proton and a pion, which each of which are quark combinations. So it turns out that in nature we don't see bare quarks, but we do see colorless particles that contain quarks. Now, just a fine point on slide 27, I told you that the strong force binds the nucleus together, and I guess the way I just presented the strong force, it really binds the quarks into the protons and neutrons. The binding within a nucleus you can think of as an exchange of pions. So in this diagram that I've got in this nucleus, you can see a proton moving along, and if you exchange quarks in the right way, it's effectively the same as exchanging a pion. And so in a way, the strong force indirectly binds the nucleus together. But a nucleus is a bit of a complicated place. So if we go to slide 28, we've talked about beta decay before. We've said that, you know, within a nucleus, a neutron can change into a proton and an electron. You actually can see the process that is thought to have happened on the left-hand side, where we have a neutron, the two D's and a U. 1D changes to a U, its charge changes, it exchanges a W with an electron, it kicks out a W as the D changes to a U, so the neutron has changed to a proton, and the W then decays into an electron and an anti-electron neutrino. And this would be a classic beta decay. On the right-hand side is, you can have all sorts of other processes happen, and I'm not going to even bother talking about that one at the moment. Let's go to slide 29, which is the last slide in this section on particle physics, and last slide on this particle physics one piece of the slides. We talked a bit about the vacuum. Remember that it will come back to us that the vacuum is a very active place. It's got particle-antiparticle pairs popping in and out of existence over a very short time. So the vacuum is actually rather complex. Okay, so that brings us to the end of the particle physics, the first set of particle physics slides. I would like you now to open up the particle physics two slides, the second set, and these are, I think they have to be PowerPoint, and the reason for this is because I used my tablet PC to write notes on PowerPoint slides, and I can save those notes, but it turns out that when I try to convert those PowerPoint slides into PDF, the writing doesn't convert, and I don't know why, but it just is a bug I'm stuck with. So let's go to particle physics 2, and I appreciate it if you would open up the first slide. So on the first slide, the title of it is called Electroweak Unification and the Higgs Particle. So what I've described for you, this idea of the four different forces conveyed by virtual particles, isn't really what we call in and of itself the standard model. The standard model comes about when we theoretically unify the electromagnetic with the weak interaction, and I'm about to tell you a little bit about that. The so-called standard model really comes about when it was discovered how to theoretically unify electromagnetism with the weak force. This isn't as crazy as you sort of heard before. Remember that we had in electromagnetism, we had discovered that there are electric phenomena and there are magnetic phenomena, and lo and behold, it was discovered that there is some relationship between the two because, for example, if I have a current moving in, an electric current moving in a magnetic field, there's a force on it, or if I have an electric current, it creates a magnetic field around it. And in order to really understand how things fit together, basically James Clerk Maxwell is the one who unified electricity and magnetism in the same set of equations, and it was seen that the electric force and the magnetic force are really sort of two faces of the same thing. So we say in physics that we've unified the electric and magnetic forces into the electromagnetic force. So this happened again, theoretically, where the weak nuclear interaction and the electromagnetic interaction were unified. And I show here on slide one a few of the players. A 1979 Nobel Prize in Physics was given for this work to Abdus Salam, Sheldon Glashow, and Steven Weinberg. Another player in this whole thing was named Peter Higgs, and in fact, one of the famous particles that we'll talk about was named after him. And I did want to point out, let's go to slide two, that in fact, one major player in this business is Dick Hagen, Carl Hagen, he goes by Dick Hagen, here at the University of Rochester. He's a theoretical physicist in our department. And just about a month ago, he received the 2010 American Physical Society J.J. Sakurai Award for Theoretical Physics. So this has not got the cachet quite of the Nobel Prize, but in fact, this was given for his contributions to much of the same work that was given the Nobel Prize in 1979. And there are people out there who say basically if the Nobel Prize could have been given to six people instead of three people, he would have won it then. So, I mean, he's done a tremendous amount of work, very important work, and I just thought it'd be fun to show that to you. At any rate, if you go to slide three, what in the world am I talking about? It turns out that prior to the 1970s, we actually had a theory of the weak interaction and beta decay, and we also had a quantum field theory of electromagnetic interaction that worked pretty well, that actually came about in the 1940s. Richard Feynman came up with this. So we had theories of these forces sort of individually. Now, both of these theories really didn't work. They worked well up to a point, but they had some real fundamental theoretical problems. It turned out that the structure of these theories would break down if the particles within them actually had mass. So we knew they weren't quite perfect theories because we know the electron has mass. We know that particles that beta decay have mass. So it wasn't perfect. And it turns out that if you take the mathematical structure of the weak interaction and the electromagnetic interaction and basically put them together in the context of a single theory and add ad hoc the existence of a different particle with certain characteristics, which we call the Higgs boson. So there's no evidence at all that the Higgs exists. You just put it in the theory and then do some mathematical tricks and do something which we call spontaneous symmetry breaking. Now, it's the spontaneous symmetry breaking happens within the course of the theory, and it just basically means within the context of the theory you have some choices that you're free to make. So those choices have to get made in order to carry the theory through. What kinds of choices am I talking about? I mean, you could imagine sitting down to a dinner table, and I have a picture from above of a dinner table down at the lower part of this slide number three. And you have dinner plates, four dinner plates, and you have four water glasses, and you have, say, silverware to the side of the dinner plate. As people sit down to the table, someone has to make a choice. Do I drink out of the water glass on my right, or do I drink out of the water glass on my left? And whenever one person decides which water glass they're drinking out of, it basically breaks the symmetry for everybody around the table. So that is an example of sort of spontaneous symmetry breaking at the dinner table. It turns out that you have some choices within this mathematical theory, and people call it spontaneous symmetry breaking. At any rate, I'm certainly not going to drag you through the math or anything, but what's really cool about this is if you take a basic structure for the weak interaction and the basic structure for the electromagnetic interaction within the context of quantum field theory, both pieces of which are truly imperfect, they don't work for massive particles, and you add ad hoc in a particle with particular characteristics, which we'll just call the Higgs boson, and then do this symmetry breaking, out pops a theory which allows massive particles. It predicts exact properties for the W and Z bosons for the weak interaction, which actually weren't so clearly established in the weak interaction theory that we had prior, as well as the photon. And the masses of the and characteristics of W and Z are predicted very, very well. And so people went out and, in fact, discovered them, which I'll tell you about in just a second. So what's the problem with this theory? I think I have a slide out of order. So I'd like you to skip to slide 5. In 1984, people actually discovered the W and the Z. We put in enough energy in the system that we could actually make W's and Z's without them being virtual particles, and we could actually watch them decay. And it turned out that these particles have exactly the properties that the standard model of this theory that I just described predicts. So this was a huge, huge victory for theoretical physics. And it basically forced us, everybody, to take the standard model, the detailed mathematical model that predicted this, very, very seriously. And it turns out that bashing together particles at up to very, very high energies, the highest we've been able to achieve, we have yet to find any process that cannot be described by the mathematical structure of the standard model. So you might say, wow, so you've discovered this theory of everything. I thought that's what physicists were after. Well, it's not quite the theory for everything, and to the extent that it works, it has some fundamental problems that we're trying to understand. So I'd now like you to go back one slide to slide 4. What is the problem? Well, we've never discovered the Higgs particle. No one's ever seen it. The mass is not constrained that tightly by the theory, although the properties are pretty well constrained. And so this is a problem. The thing is, the standard model works really well. So in order for the theory to work, we have to add in a particle with the characteristics of this Higgs particle. And that really works well. So what do we really know? We don't actually know that nature has a Higgs particle that's exactly like this. All we really know is that at low energies, or at energies sort of like we have in everyday life and like we have in our current generation of accelerators, something acts like the Higgs particle. If we were to go to very much higher energies, it's possible it might not really be a fundamental particle like Higgs. It could be a particle that has structure. It could be other things. So there are other ways to sort of solve this problem and have something act like the Higgs at lower energies. So this is the primary reason for building the Large Hadron Collider, is that we know that something does what the Higgs does, and for reasons I won't bore you with, we have pretty good reason to believe that whatever it is will show its face at energies that could be reached by the Large Hadron Collider. So the fundamental scientific reason for the construction of the Large Hadron Collider is to understand what exactly it is that does what the Higgs does. Is it a fundamental Higgs, or is it something else? And the reason to go looking for it is many of us believe it's probably something else, and that will give us clues to physics beyond the standard model, because we don't believe the standard model, or we know that the standard model isn't a theory of everything. There are lots of unresolved questions where the standard model is actually concerned, but it works so well that we know it's that something has to do with what the Higgs does. So let's now go to slide 6. Okay, so particle physics ties into cosmology because if you have the expanding universe and you basically go back in time, the universe gets smaller and hotter as we go back in time. And modern accelerators going up in energy are basically looking back at the particles and the forces that were present in nature at those times. So that's part of why I needed to go through this particle physics section and how particle physics gets very tied up with cosmology and ultimately the multiverse, because the particles and the forces help dictate the form in which the universe takes as it evolves. So that's the end of particle physics 2. I understand that this particular topic is very dense to the uninitiated, and I will try to answer questions and go through pieces of it again to give you a bit of a flavor of it. But we need to sort of have some of these concepts and some of the terminology out there as we go forth and talk about cosmology. So I really couldn't avoid it. At any rate, for Wednesday, I want you to look at the Parallel Universes show, which you'll be able to find on the course resources section of Blackboard, and I'll try to remember to send you an email about that. But it's a fun TV show that was produced for the Science Channel, and I think you'll find it interesting. If you have particular questions about this, as I say, the particleadventure.org website is actually a pretty useful place to try to learn more about particle physics. Look through that. If you have specific questions, feel free to email me. If I get a question that I think is something that many others of you might think of asking, I'll probably broadcast the answer widely, anonymously, so you don't need to worry. If you feel the question stupid, I actually don't think there is such a thing as a stupid question, but you know, I know that people are reluctant to ask them if they're going to be broadcast, but if I were to broadcast it and my answer to the class, I would do it anonymously. At any rate, hope you guys all have a good week, and I'll see you when I get back.